Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 5 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today is a first for us on Archive Fever. We're talking to a lawyer. Not just any lawyer, but a distinguished academic, jurist, and environmentalist with a remarkable commitment to justice. Professor Kate Aughty is a Vice Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Melbourne and Chair of Victoria's Environmental Protection Authority. She has formerly worked as a barrister and also held appointments as a magistrate in Victoria and in the goldfields and western desert of Western Australia, establishing Aboriginal sentencing courts in consultation with Aboriginal people. And, as if that wasn't enough, Kate is also an accomplished historian, who in 2023 released O'Leary of the Underworld, The Untold Story of the Forest River Massacre, published by Black Ink. This book uncovers the truth of what happened at Forest River up in the Kimberley in 1926, when at least 20 First Nations people were murdered by white police officers and citizens. O'Leary of the Underworld has been acclaimed by Lyndall Ryan as a major contribution to the study of frontier massacres in Australia. It's researched with a lawyer's forensic attention to detail, but written with the passion of an activist committed to justice and truth-telling about our nation's brutal past. Kate, thank you so much for joining us here today.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by going back to the beginning of your career as an archive addict. Long before you wrote O'Leary of the Underworld, before you were sort of officially a historian, you trained and worked as a lawyer. And as someone who comes from a family of lawyers, I know all too well that the law is also a very archive-heavy discipline that demands excellent research skills. Was it working in the law that you think you first sort of picked up the research bug?
No. No, it wasn't. I was a shocking law student. I hated every minute of my law degree and I was very glad when I finished it. But I've also been very glad that I did a law degree. My experience of law research was that I wasn't very good at it. And in fact, the thing that brought me back to the archives was working with Aboriginal people in my first job as an Aboriginal legal service lawyer here in Victoria. And what that taught me was that storytelling is a fascinating way to think about history, about archives, about accessibility of the narrative of the country. And it's from there that I really embarked on what I think is probably my archive journey. It's really not to do with being a lawyer. It's to do with being a person who's been cultivated and lucky to be cultivated by Aboriginal women in particular.
And was there a particular moment that you can remember or a particular archive that really triggered that interest for you?
There have been. In fact, some of the very early work that was done by the Protectorate here in Victoria was of interest to me for some work that we did about the repatriation of Aboriginal people's cultural material and skeletal remains. That was one of my first jobs with the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. And the other thing that brought me back to the archives was the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And I was really lucky to be employed in that, notwithstanding its enormous failures over time in terms of its recommendations, because it gave me a chance to marry up what Aboriginal people were telling me about their reality of the colonial story and the one that came out of the text that we really did need to explore for the Royal Commission. So it's those two things that really brought me back into it. And additional to that, there was also a time when we put together the Wadjabulluk Native Title Claim up in the Horsham area for those people who don't know the Aboriginal people's domain up there. And talking to Uncle Patrick Kennedy out at the Ebenezer Mission, he spoke to us about there being leases that had been converted from licences and 99-year leases. And we couldn't figure out where that came from until we went back to the archives and there it was. the actual oral history memory of somebody like Uncle Patrick living in a tin shed was exactly right, and people had long forgotten the story. And then finally, something that leads to some of the work in O'Leary. I was working for Pat Dodson in Western Australia with the Underlying Issues Report. I had the opportunity to be in the archives there, and I was down in the Batty Library. And I was on one lunch hour with some free time, and I went and had a look at the file on Lumbia, and that really brought me all the way back to a story that I'd first explored as an undergraduate arts student.
Kate, what do you reckon it was about the law library that didn't light your fire in the way that these other kinds of archives did?
They didn't tell the story, and we weren't taught that the story was important. So something, for instance, as really dreary and dull as wills. Wills are fascinating. You could have the most wonderful time exploring how wills talk to you about the way we've organised our society, patriarchy, who got what and why, who didn't. But wills was taught to us as this extraordinarily dreary subject, and they just were very dreary. And I came from a background where I had very left-wing parents who taught me to be a systems thinker. The law didn't want you to do that. We really didn't want to marry equity to contracts, even though the link is so obvious to anybody who really thinks about the law. And I just had this sense that it just wasn't what I wanted to do. I only finished my law degree because I was going out with an Irish man at the time who hadn't got past secondary education. And when I said I was going to stop being a law student, he said, if you dare, because he recognised the value of education.
You did go on to work as a lawyer, though. Was that something you ever considered not doing? Were you willing to ditch the law after you finished your degree?
No. After I finished my degree, I was unfortunate to have a job in the western suburbs with a particularly difficult practice, but the clients were wonderful. Yeah. And then when I left there, I walked along Gertrude Street having resigned from that job, and a job came up at the Aboriginal Legal Service. So the Aboriginal Legal Service really drew me in at a time when I was probably pretty keen not to be a lawyer, actually. Mm. Articles was a crushing time for me, notwithstanding the clients in the western suburbs who were wonderful.
So in a way, it seems like the through line of your work over many decades is working with Aboriginal people and telling their stories as opposed to being a lawyer or a historian.
I think that's right. And what I've learned is that in telling Aboriginal people's stories, we get to tell our own.
Yeah.
And they provide this wonderful window for all of us to understand our history for the last, you know, little over 200 years. They really do provide that opportunity.
So when you're listening to Aboriginal people's stories, or you're engaged in those archives that allow you to tell those stories or to give an evidence base to some of those stories, what does that feel like for you in an embodied kind of way? What does it feel like when you're in the grip of archive fever?
Oh, I get excited by it. I find myself losing track of time, losing a sense of what else needs to be done. You know, the gardening stops, nobody washes the dishes, that sort of stuff. You just sit there. I mean, O'Leary was really written at a time when we're all engaged with COVID, but I was getting out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning to change a sentence. And you just become so immersed in the process and look for things. So you find yourself looking for the link, and then you'll be thinking, ah, I remember where that is. And I'm not the best card indexer. Some people are really good at that sort of archiving. I'm not. It's got to be held in the head. But once you get the sense, it's very difficult to put it down.
You got the bug. You got bitten hard.
Got the bug, got bitten hard. And realised that when doing it, that we had this fantastic lens into ourselves personally. So in my household, we've done some work going back and reading the historical records of Australia. Now, I don't know whether anybody here has looked at them, but they've been on my father's shelves for decades and I'd never looked at them. But you go and look at them and suddenly you're finding these stories about what happened to Aboriginal people in 1794 and 1799 and 1824, and then you discover that a record's missing, and suddenly you're thinking about, where could you find that record? What about where that might be? And it's actually the investigation part of it that I think really intrigues me. And that does definitely link to being a lawyer, exploring the ways in which, as a defence lawyer, because that's what I've always done, you find ways to explain your client's story, which really can lead to people being found not guilty of crimes that they're not guilty of. So there's a justice outcome at the end of it.
Let's focus on the O'Leary book now. For anyone who's never heard of the Forest River Massacre of 1926, could you give us a brief overview of what happened?
I can. And can I just say that today is the 7th of June, the day we're recording this. This is actually the 97th year anniversary of what happened up there to some of these Aboriginal people. So it's actually quite strange that we're having this conversation. And that sometimes happens when you're doing these archival discussions too. Just odd serendipitous linkages that you never expect.
It is serendipity because we have rescheduled this interview several times to accommodate everybody's schedule. So that's one of those little messages from the universe, eh?
It is. It's a really interesting one, Claire, isn't it? And neither of us are terribly spiritual, so it's fascinating.
You speak for yourself.
Well, I'm making an assumption, which lawyers always do. The story itself, the book is about O'Leary and it's also about Lumbia. The nuts and bolts of it are that a white soldier settler who was a former light horseman and a World War I veteran was speared to death by Lumbia in May 1926. And Lumbia was then searched for, essentially, by a police and civilian posse. And that police and civilian posse killed at least 20 people that we know of and probably considerably more. The book is actually predicated upon two narratives that are, in my view, incontrovertible. And one of them is the police inspector who went out within 2 months of the first of these instances and followed the path of the police patrol. Now, he was a police inspector who had no reason to be telling this story other than trying to tell it truthfully early on. He subsequently somersaulted. However, what he found when he was taken around the sites of the police patrol was that at the first instance, four men were taken into a place called Gota Gota Mary. They were shot and they were incinerated in what was described as an improvised oven with a great big rock over a creek bed. Three women were taken from that place, and this was followed again by this police inspector and one of the Aboriginal trackers who'd been with the police patrol. And those three women were taken to a place called Moeri, and they were chained around a tree where they were shot, and the residue of the incineration of their bodies was some teeth that were found in three distinct pockets around the tree. From there, the police inspector was taken to another site by the tracker, and at that site he was confident, it's his word, he was confident that nine other people had been shot and their bodies burned. So that's the first part of the story. At various places along those sites, the police had carved iconography on trees, and there's one particular site where they carved Wadgal, and I might come back to that if we get time. And the second one was police camp number 3. So it's very clear that this was the site and the scene of those matters. And this police inspector said this is what he saw when he went around. He was in no doubt about it. The other site was one that was visited by the Royal Commissioner, because a Royal Commission was established about this particular matter. It was established, again, here's another irony, on the 26th of January 1927, what we sometimes in this country have called Australia Day. The Royal Commissioner went to one of the sites, not any of those three. He went to another site, a further site, north of the Forest River Mission, and he was taken there by some people who were part of that particular second part of the patrol, and he was confident from the size of the residual fire that four people had been shot and burnt there, two of them being men and two of them being women. So the whole story is predicated on that. What happened in the archives for me is that on that occasion when I was in Western Australia at the Batty, I asked for Lumbia's file, and I actually wanted the 1926 file of the trial where he was charged with the murder of Hay, the soldier settler. And the librarian brought out a file from 1945. Because I'm a lawyer, I said, no, that's not the file I want. I don't want that file. And the archivist said to me, I think you do. I think you do want this file, and gave me the file. So I got this 1945 file, and it was the second occasion that Lumbia had been charged with the murder or manslaughter of somebody. On this second occasion, it was his Aboriginal wife, and he was charged with manslaughter. He went through a trial in a thing called a Court of Native Affairs. They were very strange courts where juries were abolished, judges were abolished. It really wasn't the Supreme Court. There were supposed to be no appeals and there were supposed to be no death penalties. Lumbia's bench comprised the local doctor and a local hotelier who was made an Aboriginal protector for the purposes of the trial. He was found guilty of murder when he was only charged with manslaughter, so he had to be pardoned. But he had already escaped from the Wyndham lockup, So they had to punish him, notwithstanding he had a pardon, and they punished him for escaping. But that file, and this is the archive story in this, Claire, I can see you wondering where this fits in. That file is the one that took me all the way back to 1926 and made it very clear that the 1926 trial, which had been an ordinary Supreme Court trial, had also miscarried in that he should have had a very clear defence of self-defence. He hadn't really been afforded it. He was represented in that Supreme Court trial by a local inspector of Aborigines who was a former farmer from the southwest of WA, and he had a Wyndham jury. And there was just no doubt that he was going to be found guilty of murder, and when that happened, he was sentenced to death, but that was not carried out, obviously. So the archivist is the person who really set me on this path, and that then took me all the way back into the Royal Commission, which took me all the way back into these particular whites who were part of the police patrol. And their story came through from their historical records as servicemen, because O'Leary was a member of the Light Horse. Hay, the man who'd been killed by Lumbier, was a member of the 10th Light Horse. Overhoy, who was Hay's partner in the pastoral station Nulla Nulla, was also a Light Horseman. And the reality was that there was another member of that particular police patrol who was also a former World War One soldier.
Kate, can I take you back to that archivist for a moment? I'm fascinated by this. Do you think that he or she, was it
a... It was a he.
Do you think that he had been waiting for somebody to come along to ask that question, that he had put this together somehow and was just waiting for, you know, a historian, a lawyer, a proper professional person to come along and ask that question? I think that that moment of transaction is fascinating.
Look, quite probably. Before I wrote this, Neville Green has written a book about the Forest River Massacre as well, and Neville, of course, was looking into some of these issues. What I think happened on that day is that the archivist really knew that this was a file that had not been seen before. I had to dust it off. And when I did, that led to my PhD, because what I dusted off was this whole saga of these courts of native affairs. And what struck me when I was working for Pat Dodson was that something like 100 Aboriginal people in Western Australia had been processed in these courts, including Lumbier, between 1936 and 1954. And nobody seemed to remember this exercise in injustice. And that really, I found quite bizarre. Now, I don't know whether the archivist also thought that the courts of native affairs were something to be a bit troubled by. But certainly when he gave me the file, he was insistent that it was the file I wanted to look at. And it is in that file that you see the bureaucrats all talking about the fact that Lumbier should have been afforded self-defence in the first trial, that the first trial had miscarried. And that then leads to this conclusion, that even if you thought that there was some grounds for having a police patrol to find Lumbier, there was certainly never any grounds for it being what it became, which was a lynch mob. And Lumbier should have been afforded a defence of self-defence. There is a lot of talk about what happened to some of the exhibits attached to the 1927 Royal Commission. They haven't been found. Where they are, nobody seems to know. So perhaps the archivist who had the access to the 1945 file was giving me a prompt to say, this exists but other stuff doesn't.
It's like archivist as informer.
He formed a very big part of my investigation, and that did lead to this jumping off into the courts of native affairs about what had happened, the travesty of these cases. A number of people from these sorts of benches were given death penalties. They were never carried out, but they were taken from the Kimberley to Perth, where they were held for, you know, 10 and 15 years. People were given good behaviour bonds when the charge should have been dismissed. It was sort of almost like, well, look, you're in our court, we better give you something, and if we give you something, we can't just let you walk out. They were a travesty of justice, and nobody else did them. They didn't have these courts in Nigeria. The Northern Territory declined to establish them, but that's what happened here.
Going back to what you were saying a moment ago about O'Leary and Hay and the other white men all being veterans of World War One, it's so striking, I think, that fact, because, you know, we so often hold up Anzacs as the heroes of Australian history, the people we should be trying to emulate. But what you're doing in this book is showing that these particular Anzacs, at least, were actually quite barbarous murderers. Did you feel like you were consciously subverting that narrative of Australian history by drawing out their kind of military record?
I wasn't unhappy to do it. My grandfather had served in World War One, and he was not a person who ever joined the RSL or ever went on an Anzac March. And he's a person who I recall as a little kid telling us that Australians had a very bad reputation for shooting prisoners. It's a complex place. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinarily complex. What's fascinating about them all being Anzacs, though, and about being in the Light Horse is, of course, the 10th Light Horse is really the height of being in the military in Western Australia. And for Hay to be in that follows almost certainly from the fact that he was a member of the extended Forrest family, you know. So there's a range of things that all linked there. And what happened when I went and had a look at their service records is another fascinating detail emerged, and that was what we know about this date on the tree, the Wadgal tree. Mm. And O'Leary put himself forward as the person who carved the date of one of these police camps on one of these trees, on the Wadgal tree. And the commissioner made the point that a lot can happen in 2 days. And what O'Leary was saying is that he'd got the date wrong by 2 days. And it's very clear that when O'Leary was doing that, that there was something really fishy about the carving of the date, the need to tell the story in that way, and why it was O'Leary. And there was another carving on one of the trees, which was also O and L, the initials. Now, they're not just O'Leary's initials. They're also the initials for Leo Overhoy, who was one of the other members of the police patrol. When I went and got their service records, O'Leary's was full of his court-martial for assaulting somebody and also shooting his foot, or somebody shooting his foot, or having a foot injury. Overhoy's was fascinating because Overhoy did more than he needed to when he enlisted, and he put his birth date down. And his birth date was the 8th of June. Now, I don't think it was a mistake that the 8th of June was carved on the tree at Wadgal, and I don't think it was carved there by O'Leary. I think it was to represent Overhoy's birthday in the middle of this particular nasty, terrible set of events. And O'Leary had endeavoured to conceal that by claiming the carving. And again, archives demonstrated that the 8th of June was an important day, a significant day, a date not to be forgotten by somebody whose initials were L.O. and it wasn't O'Leary. That was just one of those light bulb moments as I was turning the files. And you've all probably done it. You look at something and you think to yourself, oh, gee, where's that fit in this narrative? And it was a light bulb moment, the 8th of June. And so before I even wrote this book, I produced an essay about the Wadgal tree and the 8th of June. My father laughingly said to me I was the only person in the world who could write a 5,000-word essay about one word carved on a tree in the East Kimberley. But I think there's lots of us.
It strikes me that there's a parallel there in some way with the Dig Tree and the Burke and Will story as well. Is your tree similarly a tourist attraction in any way? Assuming that it's extant, it's not extant.
Nobody, as far as I know, has seen it since the Royal Commission in 1927, although Aboriginal people almost certainly knew where it was. And Randolph Stowe, who was up there teaching at the Forest River Mission for a while, was taken out to one of the sites, so he may have been at the place. And also another woman who's written about being a teacher, Sally Hirschfeld, has been out to one of the sites. So they've been to the sites, but neither of them mentioned that they'd seen the Wadgal tree. I think that probably what happened is there was a massive clean-up after the Royal Commission, or even before the Royal Commission. There was talk that there had been a lot of rock chipped from some of these sites to remove the evidence of very significant heat, lots of ash and bone thrown into creeks and moved around. So I think it's highly unlikely that there's anything left there like the Dig Tree.
Kate, I'd like to turn now to the question of authorial voice. As has become apparent through this conversation, O'Leary of the Underworld's built on this mountain of, you know, rigorous archival evidence. But your voice in telling the story of O'Leary and the massacre is not that which we associate with the kind of dispassionate scholar. It's very, very passionate. You say things about O'Leary like he was a sophisticated and sly liar, he was a dishonest brute. And you even say, you know, some people are just evil. O'Leary was one of them. And that's striking for me, I suppose, working within the academic discipline of history, where there can be a wariness, I think, towards using sort of evaluative language. There's sort of often an unspoken assumption that our role is just to explain the past, not to judge it. So I'm really interested in how you came to adopt that voice and why it was important to you to write in that way.
I never would have written this as just an explainer.
Yeah.
My history as a magistrate setting up Koori courts here and setting up Aboriginal sentencing courts in Western Australia really instilled in me a need to make sure that if we enter into a justice space to do with Aboriginal people, somewhere along the line we are taking sides to say, not necessarily the outcome will be taking sides, but we are taking sides to say this has to be inclusive, this has to be different, it has to be a strange creation to what we might think of as the usual way of doing, in inverted commas, justice. So it never would have been just an explainer for me. I never embarked on it to do that. And in fact, I know it's not a conventional history. It's not a conventional law textbook either. Mm. In a way, it's not even a conventional true crime narrative. It was never intended to be. And it doesn't trouble me. I know it troubles historians. In fact, I think there was a review in the Australian Review of Books that made just exactly that point. Reading it, looking for that, is reading it for the wrong reason. Mm-hmm. This really was a book where I wanted to flay O'Leary alive. I make no apology for it. As far as I'm concerned, there's been 97 years of quietude about this, notwithstanding Neville Green's work. And I think it's time we stop doing that, frankly. And the thing that really strikes me when we go and read stuff like the Historical Records of Australia is you read those extraordinarily dispassionate narratives of, you know, 1794, an Aboriginal child tied up, dragged through the coals, thrown into the creek, shot, nobody's charged. You read the 1799 trial of men who shot two Aboriginal people because they thought they might have been the people who killed a white, and they later discover that didn't happen. They're found guilty, but nothing happens. You read the trial of Nathaniel Lowe, the lieutenant who captured Aboriginal people. Two were shot escaping. One is taken to the cells. He's removed from the cells on Nathaniel Lowe's directions. He's taken to a tree. He's tied to a tree. He's executed. Nathaniel Lowe is tried. Wentworth and Wardell are his lawyers. They both say, how can you possibly find anybody guilty of killing an Aboriginal person? They are a creature of nature and the laws don't apply to them. Mm-hmm. So how can we be charged with murder of them? Mm-hmm. There are littered through our archive, through our storytelling in Australia, a number of renderings of these sorts of things, which we tell and then they're forgotten. Mm. And there's a great example of that in a work that Mary Gilmore put together called More Reminiscences. And she's got one particular short story in that which is a reminiscence, which she called The Whip. Mm. And The Whip is about sitting, listening to her uncle who was replaiting a whip. And stock whips, of course, have a plait and a cracker and all the rest of it. And he was replaiting the whip. And it was quite a good whip. And everybody was sitting around saying, that's a good whip. Where did you get it from? His niece, Mary Gilmore, heard the story told as a child that he had been out looking for beasts. He thought a cow and calf had gone missing. He had the death smell, approaches the death smell, finds a 12-year-old Aboriginal girl tied to a tree with her hands tied behind her back with the whip. The whip is holding her there. We never hear whether she was shot. We don't know how she died. We do know she's dead. And he takes the whip. We don't know whether she's buried. We don't know whether she was in fact attacked by foxes or birds before she died. We've got no idea about any of that. Mary Gilmore wrote that and published it in 1935, and we remained untroubled by it. Mm-hmm. I want people to be troubled by O'Leary. I want historians to say, I hate what Kate Audy wrote, and it's not history. And I don't care if they do.
Your answer to this question, Kate, makes me think of something Tony Burch said in relation to the history wars in the early 2000s. And I don't want to put words in his mouth. I'm just going to be paraphrasing. I recall that Tony was disappointed in the majority of white historians for not realising that this was not just an intellectual matter, the history wars, that I think Tony used the phrase, this is a gutter fight. And he withdrew from the history discipline because he felt, I think, let down by his colleagues not realising that this was a gutter fight and that you needed to take sides. And it seems to me, Kate, that you're the rare white historian who is really reckoning with the fact that it's a gutter fight and you need to take sides.
I think it is a gutter fight, and I don't think it hurts the discourse to have a gutter fight. Mm. You can all disagree with me and that's good.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to be able to say to ourselves, our history is not this anodyne clinical discussion of what might or might not have happened. And I want to just say this about, we're now really all talking about the frontier war. Mm. A war suggests that there's actually a contest. Mm. It suggests that people are actually evenly pitted to some extent. A war is not something that happened to these three women who were walked from Gotagota Mary to Moeri in chains, one of them being old and blind, and then they're executed. It's the outcome of war, but they're not responding in a way that suggests that they have any capacity to engage in warlike behaviour. So I think we need to be conscious of that. Mm. I'm with Tony on the gutter war stuff, as you obviously have discerned. I also go back to a comment that Marcia Langton made, and she made the point. She said, "You hate us. You hate us." And given my background, I thought, oh, I don't actually agree with that. The more I've read, the more I've looked at what happened to Aboriginal people in our courts, the more I've been privy to how that unfolded, even to the current day, I don't disagree with Marcia any longer. And I think it's incumbent on us to be a bit prepared to say that's our story and we need to confront it. And, you know, the yes vote, Uluru, all of that's making us do it, and it's good.
Kate, I was just going to raise that question of timing. We were talking about synchronicity before, some of these things coming together. You've obviously been working on O'Leary of the Underworld in one way or another for a very long time, in some ways predated your PhD. But it's been published at this moment in our nation's history where we are about to go to a referendum on The Voice, something I know that you're also very involved in. Do you see this book working as an intervention in that debate?
I would have preferred this book was published at a different time. For the same reason that the yes vote troubles me, because I do have Aboriginal friends who have a different view than me on the need for a yes vote. And you do worry or wonder whether what you do might alienate a person whose vote you would prefer to have rather than not. And some people will take that view. They'll say, we don't need to know this. We don't need to have it exposed now. This is the past. Let's let it lie. That's just something we've got to wear, I think, and something we've got to bear. And 200 years from now, people won't remember O'Leary of the Underworld, but they might remember the fact that we had a yes vote, and they might remember that it was prompted by people who thought that it was time to do that right now. And sometimes some of what we know from our historical archival work is that the time is of the essence. You know, it's time, yeah.
I want to also ask about the region in which this book is set, on the colonial frontier in the Kimberley. That's a kind of area of Australia that can feel quite foreign for many urban white fellas living in eastern cities. But I know you've worked a lot in Western Australia yourself. How does your own experience of the region shape your approach to this story?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, because it goes way, way, way back. It goes way back. We went to live there on the order of a research station when I was a very little kid. Mm. I did my first 3 years of schooling in a one-room school there. I was exposed to my very first example of a teacher being a racist and of people taking a stand in the Kimberley at the order of a research station school. And it was an occasion when an Aboriginal girl, too frightened to ask to go to the toilet, wet her pants. Teacher rubbed her nose in her pee. We went home and talked to our parents about it. They were an enclave of scientists. Parents went and collected the teacher, put him in the car, took him to Wyndham, said, "You're on the next plane, off." It taught me that it's important to stand up. It taught me that the Kimberley was still a pretty rough place in the late 1950s, early 1960s. It taught me that scientists are good people, because if it had been down to the usual local people, that might not have happened. And after that, one of the people who lived on the research station was the first person to ever be sued by an Aboriginal person, one of the members of the Green family. Frank Karmapeski actually went from the research station to set up the hotel in Kununurra. He unhappily allowed the Green family and others to drink more than he thought they should have, but was prepared to take the money for it. Chained up the member of the Green family, having dusted him with flour, chained him to his bumper bar, held him there overnight, and then walked him down the main street of Wyndham to the police cells. And that happened after we left. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the living archive in a way. It's what people live. The story of Aboriginal people didn't really change over what I see there as a number of decades. When we did the Royal Commission for Deaths in Custody, we were in Carnarvon, and we were there one night talking to JPs. And one of the JPs said to Pat Dodson, who's so evidently an Aboriginal person of extreme presence, that he didn't think Aboriginal people should be put in jail for their offences. And we all thought that was really revolutionary, until he went on to say he thought they should be chained to the statues in the main square and publicly humiliated. So I don't think this is new, this stuff. I don't think it's gone away, and I think we need to be vigilant about it. And I think it's ugly. I think it's unpleasant. I think it's chilling. This is a fierce book, as I've said to people. It's a fierce book. It's an angry book. I must say that having written it, I'm still angry about it. But it's a book about terrible events that were when I started thinking about this within living memory of some of the people who were involved in it.
Kate, there's many other places that we can go with this, but we're unfortunately going to have to wrap things up. You started your career as a defence barrister. You clearly have become a prosecutor with this book. I'm wondering whether you stand accused of anything yourself. Do you have a dirty little archive secret that you'd like to share with us?
I've probably got hundreds of them. Look, I've got a dirty little archive secret in that I often go to Trove and I don't take the note when I should, so I have to go back and find it. And I'll just big shout out for Trove in all of this. My dirty little archive secret, I suppose, too, is that archivist coming up to me and saying, this is the file you want, and me thinking I knew better and saying no and being told it is the file you want, knowing too much, yeah. And, you know, I am aware that I've stepped out of being a defence barrister in this book.
Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us today, Kate. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but it's been an absolute pleasure.
To learn more about Kate's work, you can find her on LinkedIn or follow her on Mastodon. You can also buy O'Leary of the Underworld wherever good books are sold, preferably at your local independent bookshop. It is published by La Trobe University Press.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3 and 4 via the website archivefeverpod.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
Usually when we're focusing on the stars, for example, it can be any specific star, or it can be the constellations where we're grouping stars together, or it can also be dark regions of the sky, which are very notable to Indigenous astronomers. And those informations, because of our interconnected knowledge system, those stars will usually tell you about changes in the environment.